This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. One day, 65 million years ago, some furry primates found themselves on a raft of vegetation drifting away from their home on the African mainland.
They landed on a mysterious island and evolved into some of the most extraordinary animals you'll ever meet. The lemurs of Madagascar.
Of course, there were probably many such voyages that eventually populated Madagascar with their descendants, now known as lemurs. And they are the subject of a new IMAX movie called The Island of Lemurs, Madagascar. And several stars of the film are residents of the Duke Lemur Center. They were trained locally by behavioral manager Meg Dye, and she joins us now. Meg, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Also with us is Ann Yoder. She is the director of the Duke Lemur Center and a biology professor at Duke. Ann, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
So let's talk about how these animals got to Madagascar. It's a fascinating story, and I guess I just realized now, or just learned, that they're only in Madagascar.
That's right. To be a non-human primate in Madagascar is to be a lemur, and to be a lemur is to be in Madagascar. So that's how I always describe it.
How'd they get there?
Well, this is a great question, and it was actually the subject of my dissertation research. And so it was a great moment when I first heard Morgan Freeman state it as well-known fact that the lemurs rafted across the Mozambique Channel to found Madagascar, because I thought, wait a second, I spent a lot of years arguing with reviewers and other colleagues about whether or not that happened. But I brought with me a little quote from Sir Arthur Conan Doyle from Sherlock Holmes, and this is the way we figure these things out deductively. Once you have eliminated all which is impossible, then whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. And that's how we determined.
Wow. Well done.
The story.
I just love the idea that if only you had brought Morgan Freeman to that hearing, you could have saved yourself a lot of breath. So how did they do this? They're on rafts. Where did they come from? And tell us about these rafts. And yeah.
Well, so, you know, obviously we can't have observed this. This was a very long time ago. So we have to deduce it. What happens presently, and so we have to project this scenario into the past, which is always a little dangerous. But what happens presently is cyclones come across the Indian Ocean and they sweep over Madagascar from the east to the west, and then they hit the sort of thermal inertia of Africa and bounce back heading east. And often they pull out big chunks of riverbeds, and you can observe now big floating islands of vegetation and, you know, with standing trees even out in the Mozambique Channel. So the idea is that, you know, some very long time ago, probably around 60 million years ago, this happened, and it happened to be carrying some, you know, little lemurs.
Wow, this is like a prehistoric ferry service.
Yes.
Back and forth. This is fascinating. So, and who were these characters? Because we call them lemurs now, but they were the ancestors of the lemurs.
Right, they were the ancestors of the lemurs. And in fact, like I said, to be a non-human primate in Madagascar is to be a lemur. So by definition, you have to be in Madagascar to be a lemur. So these ancestors would have been, primitive primates, and they would have had a tooth comb, which is a little known fact. So all lemurs and their close relatives, the lorises and the bush babies, all have elongated and compressed lower teeth that they use as a comb, and they actually use it as a comb. So when you see two lemurs huddled together, which you can do at the Duke Lemur Center, and you see them using their mouths, you know, rubbing it on each other, what they're doing is they're taking that tooth comb and they're, you know, scraping up little bugs and just bonding, you know, socially. So anyway, it would have been a primate that looked very much like that, but it would have rafted across the Mozambique Channel and then gotten to Madagascar and become a lemur.
How did they? They must have done well because they're still there.
Yes.
So they apparently didn't face any predators or anything that was enough to drive them to extinction.
Well, indeed. So the way that we have deduced all of this is that they were probably the first placental mammals to arrive in Madagascar. Hmm. So they would have had no competitors that were mammals, and they would have had no predators that were mammals. That doesn't mean that there weren't birds and, you know, other creatures that might have caused problems for them, but, you know, they were the first mammals to colonize Madagascar.
Other thing that strikes me is that I just learned and getting ready for this is the variety of species.
Is extraordinary.
Wow.
Wow.
and I thought to myself, well, wait a minute. And so if you're doing well and you have such little, you know, not many predators and not much competition, why change? We're doing just fine. We don't need a niche. We are the niche.
Well, but in fact, you know, you have lemurs filling just about every niche you can imagine in Madagascar. They've had this long period of time, so they've had a lot of opportunity. And in fact, the eyes, which again, you can see at the Duke Lemur Center, are filling the woodpecker niche in Madagascar, and there are no woodpeckers in Madagascar. So they're eating the grubs inside of trees, and they don't have the competition from woodpeckers.
Maybe the reason they might have done some of the reason, I use this word reason, one of the pressures to change would be their own success. So maybe if you want to compete, we'll stop competing with ourselves.
Right,
and we'll sort
and so we'll change strategies, and do something else.
So now there's this film.
And
in order to have a film, even if it's a nature film, we need a certain amount of training. These non-monkeys, these primates, need to know how to act. And Meg, that's where you come in. You're training lemurs for the movies.
That is. And with this movie, these fat-tailed dwarf lemurs were the only ones in the movie to not play themselves. They were playing that ancestral primate.
How did you do? So what does that mean? I mean, how did you work with the film producers to get what were they asking you to do and how did you do it?
Sure. So probably about 2 months before the film started, we sat down and really kind of identified what their vision was. What would they like the lemurs to do? And from that, we took it back, worked with our technicians and came up with steps and started working with this family of five lemurs that we had never trained before. So that in itself was exciting because I think it's the first time ever fat-tailed dwarf lemurs have been trained and using positive reinforcement with them.
Certainly the first time we've ever talked about it on this show.
Probably.
So what'd you train them to do?
So we needed to train them, first of all, just to focus on us. So it's kind of like kids at preschool for the first time that are learning just to come in front of their teacher. And when we talk about training, we really talk about us being teachers and teaching the animals how to live in their environment, whether it's husbandry or research projects. And in this case, for the movie, how we taught them to station in front of us and get focused so we can work towards those behaviors we need to do for the movie.
Is there ever a danger that they get so comfortable that they start asking for their own dressing room, Perrier and the drinking
room? Not so far. Okay. Not so far.
That didn't happen. But this is a documentary, right? And it does tell the story. It's pretty accurate, do you think?
It takes a little license with the history, but it's close enough.
Because I'm thinking about training an animal to be itself or something like it. How much does that distort the picture when you train an animal to act like the animal?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think there's a great story to be told here, and I want Meg to tell it because part of the challenge is that these were nocturnal animals being trained to go towards a light.
Uh-oh.
And things got interesting.
Right. So what you do see of the animals in the film are the animals actually being themselves in the sense that, as Anne mentioned, they are nocturnal animals. So when we started training, we knew that one of the challenges we were going to have is being able to turn on the lights and have the animals train and participate in the training session. And the first time we did it, we turned on just one light and we had it focused up towards the ceiling. And within a few seconds, the animals who were fully participating in the training session slowed down and slowly made themselves back to where they go to sleep. And we all kind of looked at each other. Did that really happen? And so the next day we tried it again, and sure enough. So that was our biggest challenge.
Well, how did you fix that? Because it's hard to do a movie without lights.
Right. And we knew we couldn't undo that. That's
right.
Who they are.
Yeah,
so what we did is we just worked on very short segments. So we turn on the lights, really reinforce the animals, try to keep their attention, and then turn off the light. So we tried to keep our expectations to a very short amount of time.
How much did that expand the length of time? It seems to me it would take a lot longer to make this film.
Well, it did. And on the day of the filming, it took a lot. And luckily, the producer and the director were very patient. So we would turn the lights on. We would put in the scene, in the movie, you see an animal running up a log. And so we'd put the animal at the very base of the log where it was dark. And the director would say, action, and we'd have the animal go up the log, and many of the lemurs would just start to slow down and fall asleep in the light. And so the director would turn off the lights, and we'd wait again. So we repeated that several times.
This is when the no-dos came in.
Exactly.
That's right. Just give them some amphetamines and say, keep going, which is how they do it in Hollywood. So this is fascinating. So now you're turning them on and off. you're getting the lemurs to do their job. But the idea that they're nocturnal is part of the research. That's one of the more fascinating things about lemurs, among the many reasons we would do research on them, right, Anne? Mm-hmm. The way they not only are nocturnal, but also hibernate, and they have. Tell us about this. I want to sort of.
Well, and actually, we can fold this back into the story of how they got to Madagascar, because that's one of the predominant hypotheses, is that these, you know, it would have taken probably weeks to even a month to make this journey by raft over to Madagascar. So one of the standing hypotheses is that these animals were capable of some sort of torpor or hibernation, which we have living, you know, the dwarf lemurs and the mouse lemurs are capable of. And in fact, the dwarf lemurs hibernate half of the year in Madagascar. Mm. So the idea is that, you know, they get onto this raft and there isn't enough food or water and they just kind of go to sleep. And, you know, everything shuts down until they land. Again, we don't have, you know, time travel ability. So this is a hypothesis. But, it could play into this founding of Madagascar.
And I understand that the way they hibernate is interesting because it isn't quite the same mechanism as bears and other mammals that hibernate. And it holds some interesting promise, particularly in space travel.
Well, if we could use the same genetic switches that are acting to produce the torporing response in our dwarf lemurs in humans, then yeah, sure. I mean, it has, you know, ramifications all the way to heart surgery and space travel. And, you know, right. I mean, you can get as science fiction with it as you want. But yes, they go in nature. If you find, you know, if you come across a torporing or hibernating dwarf lemur, they all, for all intents and purposes, they look dead because they're at ambient temperature. So they feel cold to the touch. Their heart rate goes to, you know, just a couple of beats a minute. They're breathing once every 4 or 5 minutes. So you can look at, you can hold them and look at them and they feel dead. They look dead. They act dead. And their brain activity is flat.
Wow.
They're flatline.
This also describes an adolescent male.
Yeah.
Human being.
I have one of those. I know all about it.
But the other part of this is, and I probably have this wrong, let me say it and then you can correct me, that unlike, say, bears, the part of the brain that goes to sleep in the lemur kind of stays awake in the bear. There's a timing mechanism functions and it doesn't quite function.
Unfortunately, Andrew Crystal would be the best person to answer that. But I can tell you that the difference that we have observed in their sleeping pattern. So they have to sort of wake up in order to sleep when they're hibernating. So they go through these bouts of euthermia and it's very periodic. So it's like you could set your clock to it, really. So their body temperature boosts up to normothermic, as we call it, you know, so warm body temperatures, and their brain comes alive and their heart starts beating at regular rates and they start breathing. And that's when they sleep. And when dwarf lemurs sleep, they go through REM sleep like humans do. So they're dreaming. But bears and ground squirrels and so on, they have this slow wave sleep pattern. So it's a very different sort of sleep.
Which is why the lemurs are more promising for humans because we're fellow primates.
Right,
and have,
exactly.
Have some of this in common. So let's get back to our film now. And one of the highlights of the film, and I think the issues that the film highlights, is the interaction, the relationship between lemurs and the human population, which got there much later, but is very successful. The humans
are thriving. And I mean, they're certainly proliferating in Madagascar. It's a very poor country, so I wouldn't say they were doing well. It's a challenge. So as a conservation biologist, which I am, card carrying, I can tell you that when I first went to Madagascar as a young 20-something, you know, it was down with people, up with lemurs. And then you get to Madagascar and you get to know the Malagasy people, who are, as a people, are just as lovely as any group of people I've ever met. And you realize, oh, this is complicated. So you can't tell them, oh, forget about feeding your children. We need to save these lemurs. So you have to find solutions that both address the needs of the people and the needs of the lemur. And it's complicated. And there are a lot of very dedicated people like Pat Wright, who is the star of the movie, who are working very hard to make that happen. And we have a project at the Duke Lemur Center where we are working with the local people in order to try to find that, you know, cohesive solution that will address both the human needs and the needs of the animals and the forest.
Meg, I want to get back to one more question about training, and this is when you're not training lemurs to be movie stars. You're training them in research facilities, right?
We are, right. We're able to use the application of training to assist with our research at the Duke Lemur Center.
Now, again, this raises this question about whether or not if I'm studying an animal and its behavior and then I train it, does that mess up the research?
Well, we really have different types of research. So we do observe the animals out in their natural habitat enclosure and look at a lot of social dynamics, for example. But there are times when a researcher needs the animal to be very specific on its behaviors, such as grasp a pole with its foot. And so that's something that we can teach the animals how to do ahead of time. And it's like us. When we know the task ahead of time, we're more relaxed, and it helps the researcher collect their data in a much more timely manner.
I can throw in here, there's a woman who has been interested in the biomechanics of locomotion and in Shifox, and she had a force plate which was on the floor, and she would just sit and hope that the lemur would jump on the force plate. And I think it was like 6 months of hoping and nothing happened.
Right.
And then Meg came in and started training the lemurs to follow a target. So you could take the lemur and say, okay, here's the path you need to follow. And they're locomoting normally, but they're just moving along the path that you've designated. So in about 5 minutes, she collected
more data,
way more data than she had collected in 6 months prior to that.
A lot more success speeding up the scene, the research scene than in the movies. But you know, sometimes you just have to live with that. What a great thing. And what's your hope for the movie?
Oh, I hope everyone in this country will see it. It is a beautiful movie. I'm just thrilled with it. It's really like being there, for one thing. So I want to emphasize that. It's very true to Madagascar, the ambiance, the lighting. I mean, I can smell it, you know, because I've been to Madagascar quite a few times. The animals are just glorious, and you know, you really get to see their natural behaviors, and you get a sense of the interaction between the human population and the lemur. So it's just a beautiful, beautiful film. I encourage everyone from 6 months to, you know, 160 years old to go see it.
The film is Island of the Lemurs, Madagascar. It screens in Raleigh at the Marbles Kids Museum. And I want to thank my guest, Ann Yoder, the director of the Duke Lemur Center and a professor of biology. Thank you, Ann.
It was great to be here. Thank you, Frank.
And also Meg Dye is the behavioral manager at the Duke Lemur Center. Thanks so much, Meg.
Thank you, Frank.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. If you want to find out more, go to our website, stateofthings.org. I'm Frank Stachow.